A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's asking about modern attempts at large-scale barter economies. We're not talking ancient history or small hippie communes. Has anyone ever seriously tried to build a barter-based system at the city? Regional or national level? And if so, how did it go? He's asking for the obscure, colorful experiments. The ones that don't make it into the textbooks. There's a lot to dig into here.
The thing is, most of what people call barter in modern history wasn't actually barter at all. It was alternative currency. But that's what makes the question interesting. Where do you draw the line? And some of these experiments were genuinely wild. I'm thinking of the Wire Bank in Switzerland, which is still operating today, founded in 1934.
So this isn't a failed experiment we're talking about.
Not at all. The Wire Bank, W-I-R stands for Wirtschaftsring, Economic Circle, was created by two Swiss businessmen, Werner Zimmermann and Paul Enns, during the Great Depression. Switzerland was getting hammered. Deflation was crushing businesses, credit was frozen, and the official currency, the Swiss franc, was hoarded. So Zimmermann and Enns set up a mutual credit system where businesses could trade goods and services without using francs. You'd join the cooperative, and when you bought something from another member, your account would be debited in WIR credits, and theirs would be credited. It wasn't barter in the sense of my cow for your wheat. It was a parallel currency, but the essential function was the same, enabling exchange when the official money supply had seized up.
It's barter with a ledger. Barter with accounting.
Well, not exactly, but yes, that's the phrase. Barter with a ledger. And here's what's remarkable. By the 1950s, the Wire network had around 1,500 member businesses. Today, it has over 60,000. An annual turnover in WIR credits is equivalent to roughly 1.5 billion Swiss francs. It's a fully regulated, licensed bank in Switzerland. They issue loans in Swiss francs, too, but the Wire credit system is still the core identity.
The WIR credits, are they convertible? If I've got a surplus of Wire, can I swap them for francs and walk away?
That's the brilliant design. WIR credits are not convertible. You can't cash them out. If you earn WIR from selling your services, you have to spend them within the network. This creates what economists call a velocity of circulation that's decoupled from the national currency. During economic downturns, WIR activity spikes because businesses still need to trade, and they use YR when francs are tight. There was a study, Stotter I think, in 2007, that found WIR actually functions counter-cyclically to the Swiss franc economy. It stabilizes things.
It's not just a curiosity. It's a shock absorber. A secondary circulatory system.
A secondary circulatory system. That's good. And the Swiss government has largely left it alone, which is itself remarkable. Most governments get very nervous about parallel currencies. But Switzerland's federal structure and its tradition of cooperative banking gave WIR enough political cover to survive.
Which brings us to the ones that didn't survive, or the ones that got crushed.
Let's talk about Wörgl. This is the poster child for the experiment that worked too well. Wörgl is a small town in Austria. 1932, the depths of the Depression. Unemployment in the area was around 30%. The town's tax revenues had collapsed. The mayor, Michael Unterguvenberger, fantastic name, had read the works of Silvio Gesell, a German-Argentine economist who proposed something called stamp scrip. The idea was that money should decay over time, like goods do, to discourage hoarding and encourage spending.
Money with an expiration date.
Money that rusts. So, Unterguvenberger convinced the town to issue what they called work certificates, essentially local currency backed by the same amount of Austrian shillings held in a bank. But here's the twist. Each certificate had a monthly stamp fee. To keep it valid for the next month, you had to affix a stamp costing 1% of the note's face value. If you didn't stamp it, it lost its value.
Holding on to the money cost you money. A negative interest rate, but physical. You could see it.
People spent it as fast as they could. The velocity was extraordinary. the certificates circulated sometimes 20 times faster than the national skilling. The town used the stamp revenue to fund public works, roads, bridges, a water system. Unemployment in Wirgl dropped by about 25% in a single year, while it was still rising in the rest of Austria. The experiment became known as the Miracle of Wirgl. Other towns started planning their own versions.
Then the central bank killed it.
The Austrian National Bank crushed it. They sued, and in 1933 the courts ruled that the town had violated the central bank's monopoly on currency issuance. The experiment was shut down. Unemployment shot back up. Unter Guggenberger died a few months later, reportedly heartbroken.
The miracle has a second act, where the miracle gets sued out of existence. It's almost too neat as a story.
It is suspiciously neat, and historians argue about how much of Wirgl's recovery was really due to the stamp script versus the public works spending itself, which any government can do with borrowed money. But the speed of the turnaround was real, and the central bank's panic was real. They saw a threat.
WIS survived by being boring, and Swiss, and cooperative. Wirgl got shut down for being too successful and too visible.
That's one way to frame it. But let me give you another one that's even less known. The Soviet inter-enterprise barter of the 1990s. This is one of the strangest episodes in modern economic history. After the Soviet Union collapsed in 1991, the monetary system essentially disintegrated. Inflation was running at hyperinflation levels, 2,500% in 1992. Enterprises, factories, mines, energy producers couldn't get ruble credit, and even when they had rubles, the banking system was so dysfunctional that payments took months to clear.
The entire industrial economy just...
It reverted to something that looked like barter, but was actually a dense web of mutual credit and in-kind payment. By 1998, some estimates suggest that over 50% of all transactions between Russian industrial enterprises were non-monetary. We're talking about an economy with nuclear weapons and a space program, and half of it was running on barter.
What did that actually look like on the ground? A steel plant needs coal. A coal mine needs equipment. The equipment factory needs steel. You can see the loop.
It got much stranger than simple loops. There were chains of 7, 8, 9 enterprises all settling debts through each other. A tire factory would pay its workers in tires. The workers would barter the tires for food. The food distributor would trade the tires to a trucking company for transport services. The trucking company would use the tires. And somewhere in this chain, a tax obligation to the government would be paid with a shipment of whatever the factory produced.
The government accepted payment in tires?
The government accepted payment in all kinds of things. Russian regional governments in the 90s routinely accepted tax payments in goods, partly because they knew if they didn't, they'd get nothing. There's a famous case from 1996 where the government of the Altai region accepted tax payments in the form of butter, honey, and hay, and then had to figure out what to do with thousands of tons of hay.
Which I'm sure went brilliantly. No corruption, no spoilage, no warehouses full of rotting hay that someone conveniently forgot to record.
The corruption was staggering. Barter transactions are incredibly hard to value for tax purposes. If I sell you steel for 1,000,000 rubles, the tax authority knows what to assess. If I trade you steel for services rendered, we can both claim whatever value we want. The system was a paradise for tax evasion and asset stripping. It also locked enterprises into inefficient relationships. You traded with whoever would trade with you, not with whoever offered the best price or quality.
It was both a survival mechanism and a massive drag on productivity.
It kept people alive. That's the thing. When the monetary economy collapsed, barter prevented literal famine. Factories kept running, goods kept moving, people kept eating. But it also calcified the economy into something pre-modern. It took Russia most of the 2000s, with rising oil revenues and banking reform, to re-monetize the economy. And there are still pockets of barter in rural Russia today.
Let me pull us to Argentina, because I know you've read about the Trucu clubs after the 2001 collapse.
The Truexi just means barter or swap in Spanish, and this is one of the most dramatic examples of a barter economy emerging almost overnight. December 2001, Argentina defaulted on its sovereign debt. The government froze bank accounts in what was called the Corralito. People couldn't access their own money. The peso was in freefall. Unemployment hit 25%. And within weeks, barter clubs, Clubs de Truque, started appearing everywhere.
How big did this get?
At its peak in mid-2002, an estimated 2.5 to 6 million people were participating in Truku clubs across Argentina. That's in a country of about 37 million at the time. You're talking somewhere between 7 and 16% of the entire population.
2.5 to 6 million. That's a pretty wide range.
It's the nature of the thing. Nobody was keeping centralized records. These were neighborhood-level clubs, often organized in community centers, schools, church basements. The largest network was called the Red Global de Truec, the global barter network, which was neither global nor, strictly speaking, barter.
Because they issued their own currency.
They issued créditos, little paper notes printed locally denominated in credits. The idea was that you'd bring goods or services to a weekly market and the crédito served as a medium of exchange so you didn't have to find a direct counterparty. You sell your homemade bread for créditos, you use the créditos to buy a haircut, the barber uses them to buy vegetables.
It's where again, but decentralized, grassroots, and born from crisis rather than planning.
The decentralization was both its strength and its downfall. The créditos were issued by local organizers with no coordination, no backing, and no controls on how many were printed. Some clubs were responsible. Others printed créditos like confetti. Counterfeiting became rampant. Why counterfeit something that's not official currency? Because you could still use the fake créditos to buy real goods from people who couldn't tell the difference.
Grisham's law in action. Bad money drives out good, except here the bad money was the fake créditos, and the good money was also créditos, but slightly less fake.
There was a deeper problem. The Truku clubs worked reasonably well for small consumer goods, food, clothing, household items, but they couldn't handle large durable goods, rent, utilities, fuel. You couldn't pay your electricity bill in créditos. So the formal economy and the barter economy existed in parallel, and the barter economy was always the subordinate one. By 2003, as the peso stabilized and bank accounts were unfrozen, participation collapsed. By 2004, the true clubs were mostly gone.
Though not entirely, I imagine. These things leave residue.
There are still small Truku clubs operating in Argentina today, especially in poorer neighborhoods. The infrastructure never fully disappeared. And there's a lesson there. Once people learn how to trade outside the formal system, the knowledge sticks around, dormant, ready to reactivate in the next crisis.
Which brings us to Ithaca Hours. You mentioned that one to me once.
Ithaca, New York. Paul Glover, a community organizer, launched Ithaca Hours in 1991. This was not a crisis response. This was a deliberate attempt to build a local currency that would keep value circulating within the community rather than leaking out to chain stores and distant corporations. One Ithaca hour was pegged to $10, roughly the average local hourly wage at the time. The notes were printed on high-quality paper with anti-counterfeiting features. Glover was very serious about this.
People could pay their rent in these?
The network included hundreds of businesses at its peak. Restaurants, farmers, plumbers, electricians, landlords, even the local credit union. You could pay for a movie ticket in hours. There was a directory published regularly listing everyone who accepted them. And because the notes were physically beautiful, local artists designed them, they became something of a collector's item.
At least for a while.
It worked on a small scale for about 15 years. But it never broke out of the Ithaca area in a significant way, and it eventually faded. The problem was the same one that plagues all local currencies. You're asking people to hold a form of money that's only useful within a 5-mile radius, in an economy where most of what they buy comes from outside that radius. You can't pay your mortgage in Ithaca hours, you can't buy a car, you can't pay taxes.
The tax issue keeps coming up. Governments will accept all kinds of things in a crisis, as we saw in Russia. But in normal times, they want the official currency. And that alone puts a ceiling on how far any of these systems can scale.
It's the ultimate backstop. The government's power to tax in its own currency is what gives that currency its fundamental value. No alternative system can replicate that unless it becomes the government, at which point it's not an alternative, it's a revolution.
Let me circle back to something you said earlier about the difference between barter and alternative currencies. Because when I think about actual barter, direct good-for-good exchange with no intermediary token, I think about the international level. Countries trading oil for weapons, or grain for machinery, when one or both are sanctioned or short on hard currency.
That's the term, and it's enormous. The World Trade Organization and the OECD have estimated that at various points in the late 20th century, counter-trade, barter, counter-purchase, offset agreements accounted for somewhere between 5 and 30% of total world trade. The range is huge because nobody really knows. Much of it is deliberately opaque.
5 to 30% of world trade is the kind of range where you just admit you have no idea.
The OECD basically threw up its hands. But let me give you a concrete example. In the 1980s, PepsiCo had a deal with the Soviet Union where they accepted Stolichnaya vodka as payment for Pepsi concentrate. At one point, Pepsi was the largest seller of vodka in the United States. They didn't want to be in the vodka business, they wanted to sell soda. But the Soviet ruble wasn't convertible, so the only way to make the deal work was counter-trade.
Pepsi, the vodka baron of America. There's a sentence.
It got more surreal. In 1990, the Soviet Union needed to renew the deal but was short on vodka, so they paid Pepsi in warships. 17 submarines, a cruiser, a frigate, and a destroyer. PepsiCo briefly had the sixth largest navy in the world.
I'm sorry, they paid in submarines.
Pepsi's CEO at the time reportedly joked to the U.S. National Security Advisor, "We're disarming the Soviet Union faster than you are." The ships were immediately sold for scrap. Pepsi never wanted a navy. But that's the logical endpoint of large-scale barter. You end up holding things you have no use for, because the counterparty pays in whatever they have.
Which is why money was invented in the first place. The whole point of currency is to solve the double coincidence of wants. I need what you have, and you need what I have at the same time, in the same place, in the right quantities. Without that, you get Pepsi's submarine fleet.
Yet these systems keep emerging. Every time the official monetary system fails or excludes people, humans revert to barter and alternative currencies. It's like a default setting. The question is whether any of them can scale beyond crisis mode.
Let me throw one more at you that I stumbled across. The LETS movement. Local Exchange Trading Systems. This was big in the 80s and 90s, especially in Canada, the UK, Australia.
LETS is fascinating because it's pure mutual credit. No physical tokens at all. Just a ledger. You join a local LETS group, you list what you can offer and what you need, and when you provide a service to another member, your account is credited and theirs debited. No interest, no inflation, no money supply, except what members create by trading. The first LETS was started by Michael Linton in British Columbia in 1983 in a town called Comox Valley.
That's wonderfully Canadian.
It spread rapidly. By the mid-90s, there were hundreds of LETS groups across the UK alone, maybe thousands worldwide. The idea was elegant. You don't need money to be issued by a central authority. You just need a record of who owes what to whom. It's the Weir model, but even more stripped down, community scale, no banking license required. The same one that hit the Argentine Truki clubs, but in slow motion. In a small community where everyone knows everyone, LETS works reasonably well. But as the network grows, you get members who run up large negative balances and then drift away. There's no enforcement mechanism beyond social pressure. You can't repossess someone's car over negative LETS credits, so the systems tended to stay small or collapse under the weight of free riders.
The trust problem is the scaling problem. Small enough to know everyone, it works. Large enough to need formal enforcement, you've reinvented banking regulation.
Which is exactly what Wire did. They became a regulated bank. That's the path. If you want to scale, you either become part of the formal system or you get crushed by it.
There's one more I want to mention before we wrap, because it's the weirdest of the bunch. The stamp script experiments in the United States during the Great Depression. Wargo wasn't alone. There were dozens of American towns and cities that tried similar things.
Oh, this is a great one. The U.S. experiments were directly inspired by Irving Fisher, the Yale economist, one of the most respected economists of his era. In 1933, Fisher wrote a book called Stamp Script, advocating for the idea. And because the Depression was so severe, people actually listened.
How many places tried it?
At least 30 American cities and towns issued some form of stamp script in 1932 and 33. There was even a plan in St. Louis for a citywide stamp script program that got quite far along before being blocked.
Blocked by whom?
In some cases, local banks. In others, the Treasury Department. But the most direct intervention came when Roosevelt took office in March 1933. His administration was launching the New Deal, and they saw these local currencies as competition, or worse, as a threat to federal monetary control. In March 1933, Roosevelt issued an executive order effectively banning emergency currencies. The stamp script experiments died almost overnight.
The pattern is consistent. Fergal crushed by the central bank, the U.S. stamp script movement killed by executive order, WIR survived by being established before the crackdown, and by being Swiss. The Swiss don't ban things, they regulate them.
Ithaca hours survived by being too small to matter. There's a threshold of visibility. Below it, you're a charming local curiosity. Above it, you're a threat to the monetary monopoly of the state.
Which raises the question, are any of these actually barter? Or are they all just different flavors of alternative currency?
I'd say almost none of them are barter in the strict sense of direct goods for goods exchange. The true Kook clubs came closest. At the beginning, before créditos became widespread, they really were people swapping bread for vegetables directly. But as soon as the system grew beyond a few dozen people, they invented créditos. They had to. Direct barter is too inefficient beyond the village scale.
The answer to the prompt is, yes, people have tried to build large-scale barter economies, repeatedly, across continents and centuries, and what they almost always end up building is not barter, but a parallel currency system. The instinct to trade is universal. The instinct to invent money is equally universal. You can't have one without the other.
The colorful experiments are everywhere once you start looking. Wargel's miracle that got sued out of existence. Pepsi's accidental navy. The Russian industrial barter that kept a superpower's economy from collapsing entirely. 6 million Argentines trading in créditos in community centers. A Swiss cooperative bank that's been quietly running a parallel currency for over 90 years and nobody outside of economic history nerds has heard of it.
The WIR Bank might be the most successful economic experiment nobody talks about. 90 years, still operating, counter-cyclical, and it's not in the textbooks because it's too weird. It doesn't fit the narrative.
It doesn't fit the narrative that money must be issued by a sovereign state. And yet there it is, processing the equivalent of 1.5 billion Swiss francs a year.
It's the sloth of the banking world. Slow, steady, ignored by everyone. Still there, long after the flashier institutions have collapsed.
I was wondering when you'd find a way to make this about sloths.
Everything is about sloths, if you're patient enough.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1930s, Aleutian Islanders recorded debts using knotted cords called quipu, a system inherited from pre-Columbian Andean civilizations. A single quipu could encode the equivalent of a 12-page spreadsheet with different knot types representing values up to 10,000, roughly the annual tax obligation of an entire village in alpaca wool.
12 pages of spreadsheet in knots. I have questions about who verified the knots.
Alpaca wool auditors, presumably. Where does this leave us? I think the real lesson is that the line between barter and currency is blurrier than most people assume, and that these systems are not relics, they're latent. Every time the formal system breaks, people rebuild them. The knowledge doesn't go away.
The question I'm left with is whether any of these could scale in a digital age. We've got smartphones, distributed ledgers, real-time accounting. The LETS model with a modern tech stack, does that change the trust problem? Or does it just make the counterfeit creditors harder to spot?
Someone's probably building it right now. And someone else is probably printing fake créditos on it right now. The dynamic doesn't change just because the ledger is digital. But the speed of iteration might... These systems might rise and fall faster than they used to.
We'll be here to cover it when they do. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flemingtop. This has been My Weird Prompts. Find us at My Weird Prompts.
If you enjoyed this, leave us a review. It helps more than you'd think.
Until next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore. A thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the
the host indeed. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.